Hello, and welcome to the WPHP Monthly Mercury, the podcast for the Women's Print History Project. My name is Kate Moffitt, and I am one of the co-hosts of this podcast and a longtime editor on the WPHP. Today, we're bringing you the last of our bonus content that expands on our Frankensteinian episode for the Bars Nasser 2022 conference, New Romanticisms, an adventure which included a transatlantic flight, our first live recording experience in a podcast booth with an actual sound guy, thanks again, Dan, rather than our usual Zoom call recordings and pillow forts for our microphones to baffle the background noise, and multiple brilliant rounds of interviews with Pedagogy Prize adjudicator Carmen Faye Mathis, grad student prize winners Diana Little and Dana Moss, two grad students involved in running the show, Roy Bayfield and Chloe Dilworth, and the five conference plenaries, Jenny Batchelor, Manu Simrid Chander, Tricia Matthew, Noah Herringman, and Christine McHugh, as well as conference organizer extraordinaire himself, Andrew McInnes. Today's final bonus episode features our interview with Dr. Christine McHugh, who gave the Bars Stephen Copley Memorial Lecture titled Melodies of Earth and Sky, the National Air and Romantic Lyric. She is professor of Scottish Literature and Song Culture and the co-director of the Centre for Robert Burns Studies at the University of Glasgow. And most recently, she has edited Robert Burns' Songs for George Thompson and a collection of essays titled An Orkney Tapestry. Join us as we chat about airs, both songs and breathing, melodic contexts, and the intersection of song, sound, and print.
Go for it. All right. Thanks so much for joining us, Christine. We're so excited to talk to you, especially on the back of that wonderful keynote this morning.
So good.
Multiple people have mentioned how much they enjoyed hearing the song as well as your talk that you sang, how that was a really unique piece of, I don't want to say performance, but kind of like performance embedded in scholarship and how that can kind of bring things out. So we're really excited to talk to you a bit more about the ideas that you were talking about. So just to start us off, can you give us a one-ish sentence description of your keynote and what you were hoping to convey or the question you were hoping to answer?
Well, my keynote was really about the notion of musical air. And by that, I mean probably really the role of melody in basically helping the creation of romantic lyric. Mm-hmm. And in the keynote, I was kind of looking at lyrics that are written specifically with melody in mind, and also aspects of performance and sound and melody which involve breathing and involve an atmosphere that's created by performance. Hence, it's really important to include oral presentation of those songs. Right. I'm also particularly interested in song culture as it is published with music for performance. That's really my area of interest. And so bringing that alive and bringing the sound world of that moment alive, I think is really vital to what I do, actually. And I try, in every project I do, I try to share the sound world of what I'm looking at, what I'm editing or what I'm discussing. I think a lot of romantic lyric loses something when we lose the melodic context for it. And I think I was kind of really trying to make a pitch for the importance of that.
Yeah. Incredible. I love that. That was like, instead of like one sentence or one question, it was like one very specific idea that was, it was very grounded in. That was lovely. Thank you.
I was also keen. I mean, I was also very keen to, it was quite experimental. Yeah. In some ways, I was talking about songs I've been working with, I've been editing, or things that I've been thinking about for quite a long time. So a description of Burns telling us how he writes a song. I've used that for so many different lectures, but I wanted to kind of explore those in a new way and in the context of, you know, the importance of singing and the importance of breathing for singing now at this moment as well. And the whole COVID thing, I really felt had made me see things quite differently in the last 2 years. So I was also being a wee bit experimental and pitching to an audience that's really knowledgeable about the Romantic era. You know, is there substance in this for me to take some of this further? And in developing the keynote ideas, I really think there is material here that I need to do more work on. So it's been quite exciting, actually, to have the opportunity to do something like this.
Yeah, I thought that was so striking. All I could think about, you mentioned how air
obviously we need it to breathe, we need it to live. And I was thinking about how it's very life-giving. And so then if you're thinking about different kinds of airs, are they also life-giving? Are they also, you know, like singing, is that also something that's very life-giving? And to be in a live audience after years and years of COVID with all these people breathing the same air, like that was just, it was very meta somehow in a way that I found just really touching and satisfying and enjoyable as an audience member.
Breathing the same air and all the, and all that entails.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But it was interesting. It was very, very cool.
And when you think about it, I mean, I'm thinking about it, you know, as this musical ear and bringing this into a context of scholarship, which is very interested in ear and atmosphere during this time, because there's a lot of wonderful work that I mentioned. And I've just lost my trail of thought there entirely.
What was I going to say?
I think there were various comments at the end of the lecture, actually, which talked about exactly that feeling. And I did want to connect with the emotions around that, if at all possible. You know, sometimes you do, sometimes you don't.
Yeah.
But a lot of these lyrics and a lot of the melodies are, you know, there is an emotional response to them. Even Burns, who I was kind of using as an exemplar, I think reacts and responds emotionally to a melody that he then writes for. And I was quite taken and struck by people speaking to me afterwards who had felt that that sense in the lecture. Yeah.
Do you want to take that follow-up? Do you want me to follow up? I'll follow up.
All right, go for it.
Yeah, so in thinking about, you know, this, I think something that we're always very aware of on the WPHP is that we're working with print, and that means we miss things. Obviously, not everything is in print. Some things are in print in a mediated kind of fashion. And so thinking about music, for example, there are so many different valences and elements to that that are and aren't captured in print. So we'd love to hear your thoughts about how, you know, musical airs mediate song lyrics that are often printed alongside or in tension with different forms of print media. I'm thinking of like, we've got a bunch of different types of print. Music, like we've actually got like actual music, like scores, but then we've also got like books of lyrics and all sorts of things. Yeah.
And one of the things I sometimes think about too is I think I've seen it a lot in the context of like different kinds of like chapbook lyric publications where there'll be a note that's like to the tune of.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how like there's a kind of there's a kind of tune that like circulates
that you're expected to know.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yep. The lyrics. And those lyrics are written for that tune, but they aren't necessarily the only thing that goes with that tune.
That's right. That's right. So what you have here is it's actually fascinating in terms of print culture because there are a whole diverse range of ways in which song lyrics are shared. And exactly like you said, there are collections of lyrics that appear as poetry with the title of a tune or ear. I think there is a kind of general consensus in the long 18th century that there is a kind of repository of melodies or tunes or ears, as we call them, that people tend to know. So when I teach my students song culture, I'll often try and explain to them, this is kind of the equivalent of me saying, okay, here's a set of words, this is to the tune of Hey Jude or Strawberry Fields or, you know, or Eleanor Rigby or I'll use something that I just know is in, and I could use something much more current if I was much more hip, I could use things much more current. But it's that idea that this is in the ether, everybody knows this tune, or, you know, or you could choose Amazing Grace or Auld Lang Syne, you know, a tune that everybody just knows Happy Birthday or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and I think there was a generally, because in the long 18th century, we're moving very much from an oral culture to a print culture and backwards and forwards between those two cultures. I think there is an understanding of melody, which certainly in the 21st century, when we're teaching these songs, simply an audience doesn't know those. A listener, a reader doesn't necessarily know those ears, which comes back to the point I was making that it's absolutely crucial as a scholar interested in song that we share that oral, that sound world for a 21st century reader. So you've got the printed lyric just with the ear. You've then got some of the chapbooks have very basic notation. Mm-hmm. One of the really interesting things that fascinates me so much about working with song culture with musical notation at that time is that, of course, musical print mm-hmm. really progresses quite dramatically in the 18th century. Mm-hmm. So initially, you're dealing with quite a kind of primitive way of printing music. Mm-hmm. And it's quite expensive and quite time-consuming for publishers, mm-hmm. hence the reason why they don't do it. Mm-hmm. And initially, it's a punch and it's a kind of hole-and-punch mm-hmm. process. Right. But by the time you get to the turn of the century, so basically the 1770s and mm-hmm. 80s, that process is changing to be copperplate and to be engraved music. Right. And it becomes more expensive, but of course, the print runs also become bigger and the whole process eventually mm-hmm. becomes cheaper as we go into the 19th century. So there's a really interesting history of musical print story yeah. that's kind of you can track yeah. in the printing of wow. songs for performance. So you can find a whole variety of ways in which song lyrics are shared. And that's mm-hmm. not to mention periodical press,
right.
where again, songs, as with short lyrical poetry, it's very popular to have to be dropping them in. Mm-hmm, and we heard Jenny Batchelor talk about them yesterday.
Yep,
we
yeah.
saw one.
Yep,
we saw one on the slides. Yep. So again, there's ways in which she was saying that was a monthly song. I want to talk to her about that. She was saying there's a monthly song published mm-hmm. and it does have just a melody. Mm-hmm. I've worked with other periodicals during this time, including periodicals like The Harmonican, mm-hmm. where at the end of an issue of The Harmonican, there will be two or three songs published with music for piano, so that again they're encouraging that clientele who are learning to play the forte piano or have learned on the harpsichord and can accompany themselves, very much that Jane Austen, you know, we've all seen it, we've all seen it, we've seen Kate Winslet at her forte at her square piano, it's that kind of culture that many of these song sheets are published for. And it's really interesting that the commercial value of those is recognised also mm-hmm. by the publishers of magazines at the time. So, and not a huge amount of work has been done on all of these mm-hmm, facets. Right. There's a lot of really exciting work has come out in the last 10 to 15 mm-hmm. years, and there's some wonderful young scholars, Ian Newman, mm-hmm. Oscar Cox Jensen, Gillian Russell, and mm-hmm. Ian edited an issue of Studies in Romanticism based on a wonderful symposium called Song in the City, which took place a few years ago. And so there is a real connection now with song culture in quite an exciting mm-hmm. way, but it's really diverse, and it's one of the reasons why it's quite hard to get to grips with it all.
Yep. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of threads that kind of need to be married together.
Absolutely. Yep.
Okay, fun fact. I just have to throw this in here. The theme music for the WPHP is something we recorded that Candace played, and it's from a book of music. It's by Ignatius Sancho.
Yeah.
Sweet minuets, short minuets, something like that. I can't remember the year it's published.
Right now. We found the sheet music online and like printed it off.
Yeah, yeah. I think Brick and Carey, am I pronouncing the name correctly? Carey's has a website with them.
Yeah.
Some of the music.
Yeah.
And so that's where the theme music from the WPHP monthly
podcast comes
from. I don't think there's lyrics, but still, it's fun to think about that.
Yeah.
That's that. We got very attached to that. We're very attached to that theme music.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it's really important to recognise just how central that is to women in the long 18th century. I mean, it's not that men are not singing and performing. They absolutely are. A lot of the editors are and publishers are male. But a lot of the contributions are by women. So the editor who I was talking about, George Thompson, who's one of Burns's main editors, works with around 30 contemporary men and women writers. And a number of those women are really interested in writing song material and see, they want to do it because they want to do it.
Right.
But they want to do it also because there's a commercial value for them.
Mm-hmm.
So So women play, the clientele is chiefly female, but many of the contributors are also women.
Yeah.
Incredible.
And one of the things that just really jumped out at me in your keynote was sort of the transnational circulation of the airs and the lyrics as well. So you talked a bit about how Beethoven kind of like resets Burns' poem. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah.
And I was just really curious about like just the mechanics of how, Beethoven came to have this and choose to do it. And you outlined some of that, but I was wondering if you could just give us a brief precis of that.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating story. So Thomson's based in Edinburgh from the 1770s and dies at the age of 94. So he's still with us in 1851. He's an amateur musician. Yeah. He's actually a civil servant. He's working for the Board for the Arts and Manufactures in Scotland. So he's significantly involved in the export of Scottish produce, flax, hemp and linen being the main things. But he uses his connections in banking circles, but also in the diplomatic service to make connections with some of his favourite composers. When he comes to Edinburgh, he plays a bit of fiddle, he sings a little bit, and he gets involved in a series of gentlemen's concerts through an organisation called the Edinburgh Musical Society, established in the 1720s, runs through, builds their own concert hall.
Wow.
based on an Italian theatre in Parma, which is still in existence, actually, St. Cecilia's Hall in the Cowgate in Edinburgh. If you ever get a chance to go and visit, do, because it's beautifully preserved. And he attends performances there of new European music. Falls in love with the music of Haydn. He plays fiddle a little bit, so he likes to do some chamber music at home. He's involved in the very first Edinburgh Musical Festival in 1815, which profiles some Beethoven for the first time in Scotland. And he uses these diplomatic channels to make connections. So the secretary of the British legation in Vienna is a Scotsman, of course, from the northeast of Scotland, who knows the family that kind of are the movers and shakers in the Board of Trustees. Thomson makes a connection with them, and this British diplomat, you know, knocks Beethoven's door with a package from Edinburgh and says, "Are you interested?"
Wow.
And the answer is, yeah, Beethoven is interested. He's interested because it's financially expedient for him to be interested. Right. But as I was saying in my paper, I think he's genuinely interested in this whole process for other reasons. And so there is definitely a connection, a European connection. But what the little network that I ran, which was called the Romantic National Song Network, ran for a couple of years, funded by the Royal Society of Edinburgh. And we generated a really nice little website. I think it's a really nice little website. But one of the things we decided to do, and that was a network that involved musicologists, literary specialists, collections specialists, people interested in publishing history across Scotland, Ireland, Wales and England. And we looked at the creation of national songs across the century, 1750 to 1850. And one of the things we decided right at the first meeting was I wanted to do a big bibliographic exercise to track all the publications. It was just too big for us to do with
it's a lot of work.
With a wee network, we just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
But what everybody said was, why don't we tell the stories of some of these songs? Why don't we select a number of songs and tell their biographies?
Wonderful.
And that's what we did. And what came out of that was really surprising. So I wanted to kind of establish this new sense of a British song tradition. So we did three songs from each nation and three new British songs, including, of course, Rule Britannia, which appears just about 1740s, but just about, you know, we squeezed it in. But what we saw was that a number of these melodies, sometimes the lyrics, elements of the lyrics, but very often the musical airs were shared between different nations or regions.
Interesting.
And that was a surprise to me because these collections are labelled so definitely as Scotland, Ireland, Wales, or of the regions of Britain. And yet here sometimes you were finding this completely porous border between Scotland and Ireland, which is very noticeable, but actually in terms of British song culture too. So that was really a big find, actually, out of the work that we did. And I think there's much more work to do there.
I was going to say that sounds like something that needs to be followed down a little further. That sounds so, so cool. Yeah. That's amazing. So obviously, we heard your wonderful, wonderful keynote this morning, and that was so enjoyable. But what is something that you wanted to include in your keynote and you couldn't? You couldn't fit. You didn't have time.
Gosh, you know, when you think through all the drafts you've done, because these things always end up much bigger than they. Somebody asked a wonderful question about about a line in the Burns song that I sang about Fancy's Flight.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah,
about that kind of sense of flying that you get with a sense of breathing and a sense of air, which is such a good question because I had actually had a section in the in the paper about that, and I would really like to go back and do more with that. I would have liked to have spent a little bit more time on the definition of air in terms of the musical definitions, because when I dug into that at the start of the paper, I was talking about Samuel Johnson, obviously, and I was talking about Rousseau's Dictionary of Music, which is so central to musical culture in the 18th century. But I think there are much more interesting debates, and it's much more complicated than I probably, you know, gave out in this paper this morning.
I think you gestured towards that really beautifully, actually. I remember coming out of that being like, because you said, you were like, I think there's a whole book here about definitions. Fantastic. A
lot of really interesting, and actually that in itself is quite transnational, because everybody uses that everybody uses the sense of air musically. The French use it, the Italians use it, the Germans use it, the British use it. So I think there really is something more to do there that might actually connect with that sense. And the other thing I would like to have done, I suppose, is just really open out where I was going with the paper towards the end. So I was trying to gesture by bringing Beethoven in to the sense that, which somebody again spoke to me at the end of the paper and said, it really, the idea of, well, we all breathe the same air. We all breathe a global air. So, so how does that relate to the sense of breathing and the sense of our locality or where where we're placed nationally? And again, I think there just is more to do. I was really excited to get the opportunity, I think I said earlier, to try and follow up a few lines of inquiry to see really whether there were legs there. And the other one was this question of, you know, taking your native air, which is a real Austen-esque phrase. And how good it is for us to take our native air.
I wrote my master's project on women walking in Jane Austen, so
actually once, you know, I'd had a chat with one of my colleagues about this several weeks ago. And since then, she's been kind of drip feeding me, because she's over here doing some work just now, and she keeps drip feeding me. You know, I found another native air quotation. I think there's a lot more to do with that as well.
Once you start thinking about it, you start seeing it everywhere. Yeah. Women walking is the same way.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, it's everywhere.
It's everywhere. It's everywhere. And actually, Katie Halsey from Stirling came up at the end, she showed me another element of Austen, another moment in Austen where they talk about the quality of sea air. So I think, how that connects to breathing, singing, there's a lot more plotting out. I think there's a lot more mapping to do of that. Yeah. And I would love to have done a bit more of that, but time forbade it.
Yes.
Yeah. So to shift a little bit from your specific keynote out into thinking about the conference as a whole, the conference is called New Romanticisms. So we would really love to know what this conference name means to you. So taken literally, what kinds of new romanticisms are you seeing in the field now? Or more broadly, if you'd like, what do you hope to see for new romanticisms in the future?
I think it's a great theme for the conference, actually. And I haven't managed to get to the Bars Conference in recent years. I'm quite struck by the number of younger colleagues coming in. I'm struck by the real excitement around breaking down borders and barriers and looking at texts in different ways and making connections also with the present. And I think the arts and humanities, to be honest, you know, is moving in that direction because it has to be moving in that direction, and articulating why we do what we do and why it's important that we are funded to continue doing what we do means we have to make a connection. We have to show why the material we're looking at really is relevant to the present day. And I've heard several papers that have struck me because they've looked at that. They've opened the paper by talking about the moment that we live in now and then casting their eye back to a text, a writer, a theme, an idea that's absolutely central to that period that we call Romanticism, and shown why it is relevant and shown how it connects to the present. And I think that's really exciting. I think that's it shows that there's a really exciting future opening up. And, you know, there are so many areas, there are so many writers that we still really don't know much about. And, you know, I mean, we all know that because we're digging around. We're digging around with these people. You know, but we have a duty, we have a responsibility, don't we, to situate them in a way that really, really illuminates their contribution and shows why it's relevant.
So
I think, I don't know whether that's kind of dodging the question a little bit, but I just...
No, I think that was great.
I think really, that's where it is. We have to show why it's relevant now. Mm. And I have a real sense of that from this conference.
All right.
Oh, fantastic. So to wrap up, what's been your favorite part of the conference so far? Can you pick a favorite moment, something that's really stood out to you?
A feature, an element?
Something about it.
Actually, I went to a panel. Yes, I was involved in two panels yesterday that in different ways really struck me. One looked at depictions of Islam depictions of Islam and the Middle East, as we would call it now, in literature of the period, in three very different texts, and in three very different ways. And it was really illuminating. I went into that panel thinking, I don't really know very much about this at all, and I came out feeling as if I'd learned a huge amount and was actually quite inspired to read the text that had been discussed. That was really exciting. And the other panel that I really enjoyed was a panel which had been cut down by COVID, but talked about the new romantics and took me back to my teenage years and Duran Duran and Spandau Ballet and Adamant and all those guys, and talked actually really interestingly about the connections between the new romantics and, you know, the kind of bad boy radical romantics that we all know and love. And made some really interesting political connections with that.
Cool.
And I learned a little bit about rap, which was also really great. And Byron's connections with Child Gambino, which was a really fascinating, quite kind of woof panel that really got me thinking, actually. So, I think those would probably be favorite moments, to be honest. Just.
So good. Everything, I feel like everything I've attended at the conference has just been so fantastic.
And I love just being surprised by something that I don't know about. And I think that's like the beauty of a conference like this, where you can just walk into a room and be like, maybe I'll learn something.
Yeah, it is. It's a great privilege, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And there's the one thing is, of course, there's just been so many wonderful panels back to back and or side by side, and you just can't get to enough of them.
Yeah.
But thank goodness we can access those and in other ways now, which is a really really good thing.
I feel like I've got a list of things to follow up on.
Absolutely, things we need to go back to. I've got to go back to the heavy metals and the Taylor Swift panels from this morning. Actually, is my go to after the end of the conference. Yeah.
Oh, well, this has been so fantastic. Thank you so much, Christine, for coming in and chatting with us. This has been so exciting, especially like right off the back of your keynote this morning. It's been such a joy to sit in this room and chat with you.
Well, thank you so much for asking. It's been my pleasure.
A big thank you to Christine for sitting down and chatting with us. If you're also interested in songs of the 18th and 19th centuries, Scottish and otherwise, we actually have quite a fun collection of music and song in the WPHP. So if you're interested in the topic, we'd highly recommend checking out our music genre. This has been the fifth and final episode of our bonus series for our Bars Nasser 2022 New Romanticisms episode, It's Alive! If you haven't listened to our conference episode yet, it's the first episode of season 4, and you can find it anywhere you listen to your podcasts, as well as on our project website.
You can keep up with our project by checking out www.womensprinthistoryproject.com or by following us on Blue Sky at the WPHP and on Instagram at Women's Print History Project.